home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am your host, Rob Watson, and we are starting out kind of a new format that we are going to be playing with in coming weeks. I'm very excited about it. We've actually been doing it somewhat in the past, but we're formalizing a little more thoroughly. So as I've been hosting this show, and we've gotten much more towards really serious, heavy-duty topics, I've been joined by some of the best in terms of journalism, and particularly in the area of LGBT journalism. And I have two of those very renowned individuals that are going to be part of my regular roundtable. That is Brody Levesque and Karen Oakham. And they are actually on deck right now waiting to join the roundtable for tonight. But they have agreed to be on as regulars. So you'll hear their voices, their opinions, their knowledge, their expertise on an ongoing basis. I'm very, very excited about that. Tonight, we will be welcoming, once he logs on here, our special guest, Mark S. King. He is a blogger and activist. His website is My Fabulous Disease. He is a top AIDS advocate. He was diagnosed in the 1980s and began his advocacy then. He's been a blogger. He's been spokesperson on ABC News, 48 Hours, CNN, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and we will have him on tonight. But first, let me bring on our panel with Brody Levesque and Karen Oakham. Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Hey, good evening.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. We don't have Mark on yet, so I might be doing less great in a few minutes. If he's at a conference, and so I know how those things go. In the meantime, while we're waiting for him, Karen, I know you've been covering particularly the hurricane and its effect on HIV patients. What have you found out? What are you going to press with about that?
Well, actually, Michael S. Lavers, who is the international news editor for the Washington Blade, has been doing some extraordinary reporting, and he covered the AIDS conference, which we're hoping to talk to Mark King about. And knowing that we were going to discuss that, I talked to Michael about what was happening with people with HIV/AIDS in the Caribbean, because nobody's talking about that. I mean, Irma swept in as this major, serious, you know, life-changing hurricane, and as, you know, left in its wake this devastation and death, but nobody's talking about LGBT people or people who require HIV medications. So he turned me on to a couple of people. I also called Charlie Rounsett Alturi. I don't know if you're familiar with Alturi, but it's a really wonderful organization that basically looks at organizations, international organizations, LGBT and HIV, that are on the ground, and they vet those organizations, and if they have transparency and have needs, et cetera, Alturi raises funds, and it's kind of, I don't want to use the word pass-through, but it's kind of like that. They raise funds on behalf of these organizations. So I reached out to them, and one of the organizations that they're specifically raising money for is called the Caribbean Vulnerable Communities, CVC, which has been vetted by them and has apparently worked for 12 years to improve the lives of vulnerable populations in the Caribbean. That includes LGBT and people with HIV, of course. So essentially what it's CVC and another group called the Rustin Fund, R-U-S-T-I-N Fund, and they're both offering their support through the Emergency Relief Fund to help people with help people impacted by Hurricane Irma. But I can give you some information specifically. They have been working in close contact with St. Kitts, Anguilla, St. Martin, St. Martin, Antigua, Barbuda, the Dominican Republic, and to a limited extent, Cuba. Now, as you may understand or may know, some of these countries are incredibly homophobic. So
right.
For people who are HIV positive to even disclose, I mean, that would have taken a lot of guts and would have probably been a very secret thing anyway, going to their local hospital, et cetera, et cetera. So they not only face the loss of their homes, their clothing, no food, you know, having safety issues, but also to whom do they speak about getting those precious HIV meds? So
Karen, is the services that are being provided here mostly that bridge to make sure that the HIV meds are continued and being supplied and delivered on a timely basis, which is important, or are there other services that these outreaches are also picking up?
Well, they are looking for specific people that they know are clients, like mothers who are HIV positive and their children. They have those kind of lists. But right now they're working, and they're also working with, as Dr. John Water, who from CVC told me, with key informants, and he used that term, key informants and actually military transports to find and locate these people and evacuate them and get them to, you know, some safer condition where then they can not only be transported elsewhere, taken care of right then and there, especially if they, you know, have relatives in another area. Apparently, the airline LIAT has been offering, and I'm not familiar with that airline, has been offering plane tickets to people who have relatives or friends with whom they can stay in neighboring islands. Let me read to you this from his note, the doctor's note to me. For displaced persons living with HIV and on treatment, we anticipate there will be a need to facilitate ARVs and access to services wherever they are relocated to. This task could be complicated given the wide and different treatment regimens available and the possible access regulations within each locality. So we're talking about some very, very serious, complicated issues here. Not only, you know, shelter and food and comfort and safety, but, you know, for a lot of these people, if they don't get their meds, you know.
Yeah, no, it is complicated and it is scary because the thing about HIV treatment is it's manageable and you can maintain a level of good, reasonable, in fact, improved great health, but staying on that regimen, that medicine regimen is absolutely vital. It and you have to be consistent with it. And that is part of the challenge in different communities. We've seen that in the, particularly in the South, in some of the people of color communities where that education, the meds aren't made available, and the ability to have a regular regimen is not being made available. And we have a disease that is running rampant when it should be treatable. And so, yeah,
right.
It is. It's vital.
So let me give the names again of the two organizations that are doing this. The overseeing organization is called. Oops, sorry, my dogs are there's another dog out there. Alturi. I'm sorry. Alturi is Alturi, and the other organization is Caribbean Vulnerable Communities. So if people want to look into that to see if they can help, that would be greatly appreciated by these people.
Perfect, perfect. And you shouldn't have owned up that you're the one that has the dog in the background, because otherwise we would have just blamed Brody and, you know.
I have two of them, and they're very spunky.
Thank you so much.
So while we're waiting for Mark, Karen, you wrote a piece on a controversial figure in West Hollywood, Louise Hay, who passed away recently, because she's controversial because she introduced kind of a spiritual healing kind of philosophy back in the day. And for many of us, we found that to be an important addition to the AIDS culture of the time. Other people found it derogatory. What has your feedback been from that story, and what was your intent in presenting her life?
Well, my intent originally was to write an obituary. I mean, she is a very famous person nationally, internationally, but had a very special impact here in the Los Angeles and West Hollywood area. But she was controversial. I mean, she really, really helped a lot of people, because it was one of the first times that people started talking about a mind-body spiritual connection, a mind-body connection, that, you know, maybe the, you know, pain in your gut is the result of anxiety instead of, you know, some other, you know, ailment, a physical ailment or whatever. I mean, all sorts of things like that. But she was controversial because she claimed that she had healed herself of cancer. And so that wound up being, you are responsible for your own illness. You are responsible for your own disease. And, you know, I personally had a lot of friends who were both very helped by her. I went to those hayrides. I sat in those rooms. I had friends who were hoping to essentially be healed by her, to tell you the truth. But I also had friends who came to me suicidal because they were doing everything that she asked them to do, everything they were supposed to do, and they were still ill. Their disease was still progressing. They were still dying. And they thought it was their fault. And so that unnerved me. That unnerved a whole lot of people. And, you know, this was a time when there were also a lot of people who went into 12-step programs because, you know, everybody was looking for a connection, brother, sister, family, friend. You know, the isolation and the shame and the stigma that HIV/AIDS caused, still causes, but caused back then, was just horrific. I mean, this was the time when, you know, nurses would leave food trays outside. Any visitors had to come in, you know, wearing sort of like your, you know, you have to go into a sterile room or something, masks, gloves, the whole, you know, as if you're performing a surgery or something. A lot of us had to go through that, you know. So she was a very, you know, she was very controversial, but she really did offer a kind of a hope that gave personal insight to a lot of people, helped a lot of people get rid of a lot of internal junk, if you will, that may have helped them live longer. Certainly, you know, we in the Los Angeles, West Hollywood area became very, very much a spiritual vanguard, because it wasn't just Louise Hay. It was, you know, people like Marianne Williamson, who
right.
with David Kessler started Project Angel Food. And, you know, there was a turning to spirituality, which was really kind of interesting after, if you will, the hedonism of the 70s. So
that's a really good point. I actually lived through all of that. Everything you're describing, I was there and part of. I shared with you offline that I was actually part of the group of men that started in both Louise Hay and Marianne Williamson's living rooms when they were very small. And I do see people taking that line of thinking, especially if they came with the intent, you know, very linear, that this was a cure, this was the cure, and that, you know, she was going to prescribe something, they were going to do it, and boom. Most of the people that I went with did not see it as so linear. They understood that, you know, they were bringing a spiritual influence onto what we were all being faced with and the challenges we were being faced with. The environment at the time was one outside of Louise Hay was no hope, was complete darkness, was complete shun, hopelessness, awfulness. It wasn't like people were coming in and being asked to give up their meds in lieu of some spiritual healing as an alternative. It was very much a uplifting thinking to augment what was going on. I will say,
well, and remember the people who were coming into the hayrides, and I try to describe this a little bit in the piece you referred to, but you know, these are people who used to be, you know, very proud and to an extent vain about their bodies and their physiques, and the wasting syndrome had, you know, brought them down to skinny skeletons.
Right.
I mean, I could lift all these people. People came in, you know, with KS splotches all over their faces, where once they had been beautiful and, you know, Adonis-like and admired and bowed to and, you know, et cetera, craved. Now people looked at them like they were monsters. So there was not only this desperate healing, but a craving for community, for people to touch them, for people to not shun them and turn away. And that's what happened. A lot of these people were wearing adult diapers because they still had diarrhea from, you know, it was part of the disease.
Let me jump in for a second. Mark is on hold. Let me put a two-bit in here. I've known Mark for an incredibly long period of time. He's an award-winning blogger. He's an author. He's been an HIV and AIDS advocate who's been involved in cases since he tested positive in 1985. Mark's blog, My Fabulous Disease, has been awarded the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association's Excellent in Blogging Honor. HIV Equal has named King one of the 13 legendary activists in the fight against HIV. Mark has appeared as a spokesperson for the movement on ABC News, 48 Hours, CNN, and in the Wall Street Journal, of course, the New York Times. I've known Mark for an incredibly long time. Not too long ago, he got married to the love of his life. They reside in Baltimore, Maryland. And with that, I will throw it to Rob, and let's bring Mark on.
Yeah, I'll bring Mark on in just a minute. I do want to make one final point, though, about what we were talking about and close that out. What you described, Karen, was absolutely true. Men who were, you know, having to deal with humiliation because of their disease, they were being outed to their families that who didn't know and all that. In those rooms where there were hundreds of them, the affection was huge and the fearlessness was huge of people holding and touching and supporting. So it's
love
the spirit that came out of that. And with that, joining our conversation, and maybe he even has some input on this. Mark King, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rob. I'm thrilled to be here with you and Brody and Karen Oakham, a journalist that I have read and admired for decades. I don't want to make her feel old, but decades.
Ah, shucks. Yeah, my former boss already made me feel old. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem.
I had the good fortune. Karen and I had coffee in L.A., and I realized I realized it before we got together, but I confirmed it once we did. I actually knew her when she was just this spry, young gorgeous thing running around West Hollywood. So,
which
I remember that very well. I spent the 80s in Los Angeles. And when I first began writing about living with HIV, which was very shortly after testing positive in 1985, those columns that I wrote were in Frontiers magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Where she had a long career.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Very cool. So, Mark, were you involved in any of the things that we were talking about in West Hollywood at the time?
Absolutely was. Yeah, you know, Louise Hay, of course, passed away recently, and I reposted an article I had written called AIDS, Love, and Desperation at the
mm-hmm.
Louise Hay Ride. And I was there. I was, Plummer Park, West Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And, I agree with everything you've been saying in terms of her having this, what seemed at the time, a revolutionary message, which was to people, to these men, these disfigured and rejected gay men, you are worthy of love.
Mm-hmm.
You are lovable. And as simple as that seemed in that horrific nightmare of a time, it was profound. And that was her message, as simple as that. You know, there were other aspects of her philosophy that were more problematic, that people kind of took offense to, especially when she died. I was surprised by kind of the level of antipathy towards some of her philosophy when she died on social media. And basically she said, you know, you can love yourself and that disease is a reflection of your own inner love or what have you. And if you love yourself, you can heal yourself. Well, what about all those people that didn't heal themselves? What about all those people that died? What, they didn't love themselves? So the flip side of her philosophy was a little problematic. And I recognized that even at the time, but it was undeniable that she wasn't talking the flip side. She was simply saying, love yourself. She wasn't claiming that you're going to cure yourself of AIDS. She was being much more simple than that. She was just saying, you, all of you here in this hall, all of these men crammed into this hall, you are all worth loving. And for somebody who had been, you know, rejected by their family and kicked out by their gay roommate, that had quite a message. And so I attended those with my gay brother and his partner. His partner would later die of AIDS. But he saw those hay rides as a networking opportunity, you know, as much as for the inspiration. Everybody was, you know, cuddled outside afterwards taking notes on what's the new drug and where's the trial and what have you heard.
Right.
And so the guys were really using that as, it was their version of crowdsourcing back in the day.
Yeah, and I think that happened a lot there because a lot of the things she brought in were, it was really kind of a hodgepodge. It wasn't like it was all necessarily even one philosophy. She brought in a lot of alternate healing people, and some of them were, quite frankly, the most bizarre individuals you would ever want to meet. And they had all sorts of weird stuff going on. But again, we were dealing with a time where medical science was bereft of answers and full of rejection. You know, so
We were literally grasping at straws. You know,
right.
While when her talk was over at these things, they would invite you to come lay on a massage table over to one side where all of these healers would do stuff to you and put crystals on your body and
mm-hmm.
all of that. And we're like, bring it on, whatever, bring it on. What do I got to lose? You know, I worked at the first AIDS organization in Los Angeles called the Shanti Foundation. We helped people die. We trained volunteers
right.
to help people die with dignity.
Daniel Warner,
the late, very great
yeah.
Daniel Warner. And I had people come into my office all the time that had the cure. They had it. They just wanted me to know about it. When I'll never forget this guy coming in. He had this box. He had like this wooden box. It was looked like something he made in shop class. And he's starting to tell me about how, and he opens the box and there's all of these like wires in there and stuff. And as he's telling me about what it is, he puts a little clip, you know, on one of my fingers. And then then as he's reaching for my other hand to put a clip on that one, he's telling me about how the electrical current I feel may be painful, but it's going to release me of all of my, and I'm like, no, thank you. You know, I mean, I pulled that thing off my finger so fast. I don't know what was in that box. I did not want to know, you know, everything from, you know, the Looney Tunes stuff, to shark cartilage, to Compound Q, to people going. I had a friend that would go to a hotel to try this experimental medication where they would inject him, not in a hospital even.
Right.
This was so like underground that he would have to go to a hotel where they would inject him, and a nurse-ish person would sit there and watch him all night to make sure he didn't die from it, you know. That was the environment in which we lived. And I'll tell you, just hearing you talk about Louis Hay and all of that, I was listening to you going, wow, my God, it never ceases to amaze me how far we've come, how much we've learned as a community, what we meant to each other then, how we all grew up and put on our big boy and big girl pants. You know, I was 24 years old. I tested positive. I thought I was going to get to be, you know, just a young pretty boy for a lot longer and do all sorts of shallow things. And instead, I had to deal with mortality and the death of those closest to me and hatred and bigotry and God. And it's
but
like all those big questions in life.
That what you just described is kind of what I take from people like Bambi Salcedo and, you know, a number of the transgender women of color in particular who
yes.
are activists who are also HIV positive. I mean, there's layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of going, wait a second, okay, finally you've admitted me because I crashed through the doors and we made our way up to your stage. Finally we're up on the stage, but who's paying any attention really? I mean, what, you know, there's this kind of comparison back in the day when nobody would listen to people with AIDS. You know, I was one of Michael Callan's care providers, and, you know, he lived right down the street from me, so I learned a lot from him as I was, you know, caring for him. And a lot of it was about, well, where is the voice? We need to be at the table. We need to have, and Beaver Staley said this, a lot of the ACT UP people said this, you cannot have discussions about people who are HIV positive or who have AIDS and just talk policy. If you're going to be talking about this subject, we need to be at the table. And
yes,
that seems to have disappeared. Mm-hmm. Why is Bambi still having to crash through the doors and crash onto the stage?
Because we all have such, apparently, humanity at large has a very short attention span and a very bad memory, and we have to keep learning the same lessons over and over again. I don't know how many more, you know, I've been at this for 30-something years. You know, if I have to explain to somebody again why moral debates and moral judgments about the behavior of other people only benefits HIV. It does no good whatsoever. If you want to have a moral judgment about who's having more sex than you are, or who's on PrEP and is therefore more promiscuous than you think they should be, you know, all of that stuff is it only benefits HIV. So I just think that we have to keep learning these same lessons over and over, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think
Mark,
there's
if you don't mind my asking a question.
What was that, Brody?
I said, if you don't, I was going to ask Mark a question based on what Karen just talked about. In your latest video blog, you talked about a young lady of color named Takiya, and you had said, you know, it's 25 years that you've been attending the U.S. Conference on AIDS, which we'll get to here in a little while. You had never run across a story like this, and, you know, based on what Karen just said, and you spent your time at the conference running around with Takiya, would you mind sharing just a few moments of your impressions for that? Because I found that to be very significant.
Well, it was really moving to me. You know, I just attended the United States Conference on AIDS, and it's I've been going for a very long time. It's got a lot of community-based organizations going, but there's health department people, federal people, et cetera. It's a very large conference. And, you know, the first day I was there, I met a woman from North Carolina. She is the mother of two. She works in a factory. She tested HIV positive a few months ago. And she immediately got online. She doesn't know anybody and anywhere in any way involved with any of this stuff, and had the presence of mind and the wherewithal to get online, start learning about it, heard that there was this conference, heard they had scholarships, applied for one, and went to it all by herself. And
wow,
that level of just, you know, good old patient empowerment, you know, is something she has instinctively that we, of course, we've been trying to teach people for decades. But it also confounded so many stereotypes. She's a black woman living in the South. You know, she doesn't need rescuing, thank you very much. She needs resources. She needs resources to help her get to the next thing. And in terms of just social stigma and all of that, she's starting at square one. It's as if, you know, she's not in a metropolitan area. She can't disclose, as, you know, openly to whoever she cares to. I mean, she's very well equipped to find out what she needs and go find it, like attending this conference. But, you know, only her closest family members even know about this. What kind of response do you think she'd get from her coworkers, you know, and our an extended family or friends, you know? She, you know, in terms of, I really do believe that as people with HIV have gotten healthier, HIV stigma, social stigma, has grown worse. It's almost as if we're not valiant victims anymore, you know, dying these horrible deaths. Now we're among you. You know, when new drugs came out, we return, as gay men, we returned to the dance floor and the sex clubs, and we said, we want to be part of this culture again, and you're going to have to deal with us and you know, deal with, you know, the sexual politics of what that means to now have people with HIV who are not dying and are not these tragic victims, but in fact are full sexual human beings. What does that look like? And suddenly the HIV stigma came out very publicly. It comes out in the dating apps. It comes out in the interactions in the bar. You know, it's so anyway, yeah.
Yeah, Mark, you wrote a piece, actually, about Daddy Bear app that really characterized exactly what you're talking about. Can you tell us that story and what that was about?
This ridiculous dating app, you know, I mean, it's not ridiculous because who they're trying to attract. It's ridiculous in that the people doing the app were pretty naive about the terrain of how you talk about HIV and all of that. It was a Daddy Bear app that promises to hook up daddies, older men, I guess, with bears. Interesting combination. Nothing wrong with that.
interesting target market. Okay, right.
Yes, it is. You know, it's not like, you know, daddies with boys or bears with cubs. Daddies with bears. I get the feeling that this is one of these things where it is some sort of foreign market that decide, you know, that introduces straight men to their new young Taiwanese bride or something, and they decided they'd get into the gay market, so they bought some app and nobody explained to them that maybe that wasn't the right combo. I don't know, but anyway, so there they do, and in there on their website they say something about how we have only, you know, the best bears for their daddies, and they're only safe and healthy. and when somebody, when a reporter confronted them about this and wrote a letter to, like, the CEO or whoever, who went by, like, Lenny or some first name only guy that responded, he said, well, you know, we try our best to make sure that our users don't have HIV because daddies would not want to have a bear with HIV, and people with HIV should probably only date one another. But he, again, he kind of answered this question kind of in a broken English sort of way that, nothing against that. What I'm saying is that the person answering and the people behind this app clearly don't have any cultural sensitivity when it comes to HIV. So let's say that they're just complete imbeciles and don't know what they're doing. The sad part is it's not very far removed from what's happening right now on Grindr and Scruff. Right this moment, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of my point, because when you go on those kind of forums, the ignorance about HIV and what it all means is stuck 10, 15, 20 years ago. I mean, it has not elevated.
Well, or is it? Or has it, you know, in other words, or is it worse? Because now, you know, behind the veil of the internet, you can let your personal preferences, i.e. discriminations, be free and open. No blacks, no femmes, no fats, no guys with HIV, you know. So it kind of lays bare everybody's personal prejudices, whatever they may be. And HIV is certainly part of that. You have people that have no open prejudices towards body types or race, but won't date a POS guy, or will you know, reject that POS person on the thing, even if that or reject someone who is negative and says they're on PrEP. I've seen people rejected who were HIV negative, but because they said they were on PrEP in their profile, it was assumed they must be some sort of, you know, world-class slut.
Right.
You know, as opposed to a person protecting themselves.
Yeah, and that's kind of my point, is the irony behind the ignorance is that for HIV negative men who are out in the dating scene or the tricking scene or whatever, and, you know, as you have conversations, their level of quote-unquote safe sex is either, you know, they don't really want to have it, or they have very, you know, a very standard set of safe sex, but they're really looking to be uninhibited. And their search for other HIV negative men is actually putting them in the pool of the people who are the most potential of infecting them. Because current landscape, with HIV positive men being, most of whom are being treated and undetectable, and negative men on PrEP who are undetectable and protected, the HIV men who think they're HIV negative, who actually have become infected, are the ones who are highly potent in terms of an encounter. And so these men who are, or being so quote-unquote selective, are literally selecting the poison pills.
Yes, it is ironic. You know, it's because sooner or later, we're all going to have to play ball. And we have to play ball in this new reality where there are these new tools, PrEP and being undetectable or not being infectious because you have an undetectable viral load. People are going to have to get on board that one way or another because it's, first of all, new science and it's how we're going to end the epidemic. We are going to end this epidemic by stopping HIV in these arenas. And if you're going to reject that somehow, you're going to become a statistic. Now, it's also true that not everyone with HIV is undetectable. You know, not nearly enough of us are. That takes compliance and being on a regimen that works for you. And that is limited to those who are privileged enough to have good insurance and access to health care. Not everyone is. That's why rates of HIV are so terribly tragic in the South, where you have poorer people with less access. You know, so.
And that's the other thing, is that undetectable does not mean cure. That, you know, without adherence, there's the possibility that you could, you know, HIV could come roaring back.
I am not as skeptical as you are about that, Karen, because my experience has been that someone who achieves undetectability, unless they have something catastrophic happen to their health care, very rarely does that virus come back. And the reason is because it takes a certain amount of time to achieve it. And by then you have demonstrated that you are a compliant patient that has a doctor and is on meds. You're very likely to stay that way. If you lose your health care, if suddenly something happens that interrupts that, yes.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about. Whether it's I'm tired of this stupid regimen anyway. I'm going to take a vacation from medication. That's number one. But the other thing, and I wanted to ask you about this almost like as a political question, because you did go to the AIDS conference. One of the things that, you know, Fauci seems to say and Pelosi seems to say, you know, as you just said, we're going to end this. But we seemed on the track to end HIV/AIDS until this new administration. And Lord knows what this new administration is going to do. Did anybody talk about that at the AIDS conference about how, you know, there's Ryan White is going to continue at the same level of funding or increased funding or...
You know, it's funny you should ask that, because I felt as if that Trump was the elephant in the room that was only referred to occasionally. And you're absolutely right. The man is a threat to humanity in more ways than one. I mean, on all sorts of levels, and we all know what they are. But purely from a funding standpoint and the billions of dollars that in his budget is cut from the NIH for research, that is cut from HHS for programs like Ryan White. I would not be sitting here talking to you on this phone right now if it were not for the Ryan White Care Act, because I had to access that to get clinical care and to get meds during a time when I needed it. Years ago, I would not be sitting here. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. So yes, it was strange. It was like he was an elephant in the room that wasn't directly addressed very often. And yet, you're absolutely right. The decisions our government makes about funding of these things has a direct effect on whether people will live or die.
Well, and not only that, but the people whispering in Trump's ears are Mike Pence and the religious right and Tony Perkins and all those, religious, fundamentalist pastors. Yeah. I mean, the guy claims to be a germaphobe, but what do we see? We see all these people in the Oval Office laying hands on him. So who do you think is going to be most impacted? It's going to be people of color in the South, LGBT people, trans people, because, as Falwell, Robertson, whoever the hell it was, said, you know, AIDS is God's punishment to these poor homosexuals, Pat Buchanan said, you know, who are perverted. So, I mean, when is that going to start infecting, reinfecting public policy?
It certainly may with this budget because it's all about money. I mean, it has, you know, we now have the science and they can't take that from us. They can't take the fact that PrEP exists now or that we know that people who are undetectable cannot transmit the virus to their partners. They can't take that from us. The question is now, what are they going to do to help us spread that message and make those clinical services available to everyone who needs it? And I don't know that there's anything in the budget. What I do see in Trump's budget is a lot of money toward abstinence-based education.
There you go. It's
behavior-oriented. You know, which the Obama administration had seen for, you know, the ridiculous notion that it was. And there it is, back in the budget.
That's right.
Well, let me hop in for a second. Let me ask you this. When you're working on this and you're an activist and you're on the front lines, you know, what are going to be the solutions? Because realistically, we're stuck with this guy until at least 2020, you know, unless something else happens. So what do the communities, what do the communities do? What do activists like you do? What is the messaging that we need to get out there, okay, about this issue? Mm-hmm. Because that money won't be there.
Well, you know, we've been here before, and we've been here under even worse circumstances, and that was in the 80s under Reagan. And it became a very ground-up, grassroots organizational effort to get out information to people. Now, people were listening. Their ears were open during those years because, people were dying left and right. So there will be a challenge now to do that. But it's funny you should ask that question because the first day of the conference was devoted to a very organized campaign for all of us to go visit our elected officials and talk to their staff and, you know, tell them what we thought of the budget and how we wanted them to keep AIDS and HIV in the top of their minds. It was fascinating for me to – I won't say who it was, but I sat down with the legislative assistants and the health policy person for this elected official who is a Democrat, who is outspoken and liberal and all the wonderful things we want him to be. And I have never seen two people in a kind of, you know, Washington, D.C. context in their office look as defeated as these two people did. They looked exhausted and defeated, and they said, you know, well, there's just not a lot we can do in this current environment, and we're doing our best, but it's really, really hard. And I said, well, you know, what can I tell my friends to do about this? What should we be doing? You know, we know that you are on our side, but what about, what can we do? And they're like, they're just shaking their heads, looking at me, going, literally saying, I don't know. I don't know. And then I said, what about 2018? Will this wave of the Women's March and people going back to their communities and running for office, will that take it? You know, will this outrage against Trump and this newfound, you know, will this make a difference in the 2000 elections? And they shake their heads and go, probably not. I mean, I'm serious. It was like the most depressing conversation I've ever had on the Hill. They said no. They said with gerrymandering and all of that, very few Republican seats are really in play. They said, and this one lady says, I'm sorry, I wish I had better news. I wish I had a plan. She said, if I had a plan, believe me, we would be doing it. And that was kind of it. And I'm kind of like, okay. You know, it really was sobering. And I'm thinking, you're going to make me tell you? I was in the office of Oh my God, my mind just went blank. Hold on, and I'll remember it in a second.
Okay, in a minute. When it comes to you, Mark, we've got 10 minutes left. Mark, what were some big takeaways from this conference? What should people know now about the current state of AIDS?
They should know that our crisis. They should know that the crisis of HIV in the American South is as bad as it is in sub-Saharan Africa, and in some ways it's worse. They should know that social stigma is as bad as ever, and we all have an opportunity to do something about it, and that is by calling it out. And whether you have are invested in this game, as it were, or not, when you see it online, when you see it on your social apps, when you see it on a dating app or what have you, you call it out. That there are cofactors to HIV infection that are insidious and we're not talking about, like crystal meth addiction among gay men.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm seeing friends of mine or people I once knew who are disappearing off the scene in a very, very strange and spooky way that they once did because of AIDS, and it's because of crystal meth.
Mm-hmm.
And as a former crystal meth addict, now in recovery for several years, I'm terribly concerned about that, and it's absolutely a cofactor to HIV infection.
Right. Because is that in conjunction with med regimens, or is there another cofactor aspect to it?
It affects everything. It affects people who are positive and they're not being as compliant because you're up for days not thinking about it. It affects people who are negative, who are high and not thinking straight and are having risky sex. I always say I was a meth addict for years. I don't think I saw a condom in once in all of the interactions I had while high.
Could I interject just one quick thing here? Because, you know, during the crystal meth crisis in West Hollywood, we created a meth column in Los Angeles Magazine and then for Frontiers. And I'm going to be recreating that, doing a column again for the Los Angeles Blade. But one thing that Kathy Watt, who you may remember, Mark, from the Van Ness Recovery House, one of the things that she pointed out is that so many people think that oral sex is, you know, not a problem. I mean, no problem having oral sex. And she said, if you're a crystal meth addict, you have gum problems. You have teeth problems. That means that your whole mouth is an open sore. So that while you are HIV negative, but you're a crystal meth addict, if you are, you know, having oral sex with somebody who's positive without using a condom, you could become infected simply because you've got these open sores.
Yeah. That makes it much more likely. You're absolutely right. You know, meth addiction is stripping us of so much. You know, it's almost like HIV is not even the worst of it when you think of just the lives that are being destroyed. And that's another thing that we can talk about, that we have the ability to do. If you are a gay man and you are on the apps and somebody says, hey, do you party? You want to come party? You know, meaning do drugs, and you don't, it's okay to say to them, I don't. And, you know,
right.
I think meth addiction is hurting our community. And there is help available, and I hope you seek it out. Not in a judgmental way. You don't have to lecture them. Just let them know, because you might plant a seed in that person. You know, sometimes it takes a lot of...
Really important point.
Yeah. In fact, I would suggest, I would like to propose to this panel that we do a show completely on meth. because I do think that is, I mean, it's interrelated, obviously, with the HIV issue, but it on its own has its own epidemic qualities. And I think talking about that might be a productive episode of this. Mark, on the piece on the South, and we only have about 5 minutes left, what is some of the prescriptive things that our people are coming up with to address that issue, that cultural, limited knowledge oppression that is happening in the South that is creating the disease epidemic there?
They're not, well, I'll put it this way, they're not getting much help from their local government. That much we know, of course, and because you have states here that haven't expanded Medicare, they haven't, kept Medicaid, they haven't done, much to help folks like that. And so it's kind of a ground up thing, and because we don't have any other choices. And I beyond that, I don't know. The agencies that are there that are working in the South are doing fantastic work with very little resources and doing the very best that they can. It's also true that I'd like to just point out that we see the rates among young black men and we wonder what's wrong with them. Why are they having so much unsafe sex? Why aren't they getting the message? That's not it at all. The fact is that of the matter is that because the pool of within that community has so much more HIV to begin with, it's more saturated with HIV.
Right.
Then the risk any particular young black man takes when he has one unsafe encounter is much greater than if he were white and having sex with, his white friends. It's
right.
A much greater risk that he's taking. And through no fault of his own, his one mistake bears a greater risk and consequence than his white counterpart.
And
yeah,
that's true for the Latino community as well, the young Latinos.
Yeah, it is. Very much
yeah,
so.
Yeah. Although I think statistically the Southeast is being hit the hardest with this.
Mm-hmm.
The down low environment, the stigma, and to Mark's point, the complete devoid help from those local governments, which we're talking Mike Pence philosophy. State by state, those cases, it's a huge, huge issue. Mark, we've got
only about
2 minutes left. I want to know: can you tell us a little about the "You've Got This" campaign? What is that about, and how's it going?
Well, it's fine. That was actually a social media campaign that was done a couple of years back, but I liked it so much that the video I did for it kind of still makes the rounds. And it was just advice for newly diagnosed people from people who have HIV and are offering their support and advice. And so I just like that campaign. I want to say that just almost every topic we've just talked about in terms of black gay men and Louise Hay and Crystal Meth and the conference are the most recent posts that I have on My Fabulous Disease. and so you're completely going in my head because those are the things that I've been talking about most recently, including a post that I did where I realized that if I wanted to talk about crystal meth, I need to talk about more explicitly in my blog than I have in the past. Mm-hmm. I generally don't go into details about my own history of drug addiction. Well, I decided to do it and start telling stories about what happened to me out there and what it was like. And there's an extremely explicit story on there about what happened to me during a very scary night. And
I've got to interrupt you because we're down to our last few seconds here. Blog is myfabulousdisease.com. I want to thank you for joining us tonight on Rated LGBT Radio. Thanks, as always, to Karen and Brody for joining us. Also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz on Saturday nights, www.ksco.com at 7 p.m. Mark, thank you so much for your work. And
thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Everything you're doing. It's really appreciated, really important. And we didn't even scratch the surface, so I'd love to have you come back sometime soon, if you're willing.
Sure. Thanks so very much for the invite. I'll be happy to.
Great. So you've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We'll be back here next Thursday night, 7 p.m., same blog time, same blog channel. We will talk to you then.